You're listening to KTOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The seven personal stories you are about to hear were told at the Season 3 premiere event on October 9th at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Coming Home. Music was performed by Dan Kirkwood. Our first speaker tonight is Michael Cohan. Michael was born and raised in Juneau. She loves it here and is constantly amazed at the new places and experiences that are discovered every day, living in such a unique environment. Michael has had the opportunity to travel around, volunteering and exploring different cultures and people. She has worked with tourists, whales, fish, high school students, university students, fish again, and now bats and amphibians. She spends her days walking in the woods with her dog, Gus, looking for bat hideouts. Please welcome to the stage, Michael.
My story takes place in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia, in a province of Svirang, in a village of Svitrum. And some of you have been there, actually. And this is where I volunteered for 2 years of my life. And in the Christmas, the holiday season of 2008, I was about to experience my first holiday away from my family. So this story is, in fact, about not coming home. In the first year and a half that I lived in Cambodia, I learned a couple things. The first thing was that it was always hot. No matter what people would tell me about there being a cold season that came along with the rain, it was, in my world, very hot. I never once looked at a temperature gauge, but the way I gauged my hotness was by what time in the morning I would start sweating. And in the hot months, which were April and May, June, July, August, September, and October, I would start sweating around 7 a.m. every morning. And the second thing I learned about my community where I was in Svitrum was that people love to drink. They love to drink rice wine, or sra sa, which is a fermented beverage that they make out of rice, which is found everywhere. And I tested this out on many of my visitors that came and visited me, and it usually resulted in a really fun time. However, if you're any of my little brothers, it just resulted in a disaster. The third thing I learned about the people in my village was that instead of asking about your emotional status, because there are a few words to describe how you're feeling in Khmer, or the local language, they would ask you two questions, and that was, where do you go, or dona? And where do you come back from? Mokbina. And so that was their way of keeping tabs on you or feeling like they know where you are at all times. And it was on Christmas Eve that I was coming back from the high school and going to the village market that I ran into my favorite woman, Ming Kom, the local midwife in town. And I asked her my usual question, which was, do you have any big-stomached people right now? And she replied, yes, I have a woman with a hurt belly. And that, in translation, meant, do you have any pregnant women at the health center now? And she replied, yes, there's one woman in labor. And so, being eager to witness this, she told me, come back to the health center later tonight, and I'm sure you'll be there in time. And so at 1 a.m. on Christmas Day, I hoisted my skirts up and crawled over my gate of my house and ran across the street to the health center. And as I walked into the health center, I noticed that my request to be a part of this birth was superfluous. Everybody in the village was there. And so I was led into the health center and into the birthing room. And as I passed by people in the village that had set up their resting places or mosquito nets on different sides of the room, I took in what the birthing room really was. And it was no bigger than an entryway of your house. And set up in the corner was a tube light that was being charged by a battery, and mice were scurrying around the floor, and mosquitoes were everywhere, and people were put into little puzzle pieces around the room so we could all fit. And at this point, I had no idea what my role was. I was just excited to be there. And I put myself into the corner, hoping not to be noticed or not to cause any, excitement. And the lody that was in labor, Bopa, had said that it was okay for me to be there earlier. So I didn't really know what my spot was. And before I knew it, Ming Kom, the midwife, was describing the different levels of pain and checking in with Bopa. And she would talk to her and ask her, does it hurt in your teeth? Does it hurt in your upper stomach? Does it hurt in your lower stomach? And by the time it hurt for Bopa to go poop, everybody in the room was hoisting her up onto the cot. And when she was lying on the cot, Ming Kom dragged me out of my corner and put me right beside her on her hip. And that meant I was staring bird's eye view of what was about to happen. And at one point I looked up, and with the dim light from the tube light and the humming of the battery and the mosquitoes and people shuffling their feet, I was able to kind of take in the picture. And it was a semicircle of all the village members. I mean, it was not just her family. We had the community chief there, the police chief. We had the lady that sold fruit in the morning. And so people that I was familiar with were all standing there, and they all started chanting push. And that in Khmer is ut. And so at one point there was just this semicircle of people chanting ut, 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 ut. And before I knew it, the head was out. And Ming Kom was strategically at work trying to pry out the rest of the body, and everybody went silent. And then the left arm came out. And then immediately after that, the baby was in my arms, and I had no idea what to do. And so I tried to follow what she was doing, and we started to rub off the white opaque liquid known as vernix off the baby and start rubbing the chest. And at this point, I realized I wasn't breathing. I looked up, and nobody else was breathing in the room either. The baby's face was blue, and we were voraciously rubbing the body. And Ming Kom handed me this archaic tool that I don't know if any of you have seen Princess Bride, but it's what Miracle Max uses. And I was pushing air into the lungs. And I had no idea how fast I should be doing this or what I was doing, but somehow it worked. And the baby's blue face let out this small yell. And everybody, it was a communal exhale in the room. We all started breathing again. And the men walked out of the room muttering to themselves, I don't know why they make such a big deal out of this. This always works out. I was never worried. And immediately after that, rice wine was being cheered and people were drinking. And after, when Bopa was all cleaned up and she was able to watch us weigh her baby, which was a surprising 9 pounds, that's 1/10 of her body weight, which is ridiculous. She looked at me, and I could just tell that I was part of her family now. This was a community event, and instead of me coming home to my family in Juneau, I felt more integrated in my family now in Cambodia, in my other home known as Phai Trum. Thank you.
Michelle Hale was born in 1961 at St. Anne's. Michelle has spent most of her life in the Alexander Archipelago. When she was 10, her mother, thinking that Juneau was far too big a city to raise her three children in, moved the family to Craig. A year later, Craig, with a population of 300, was too big. And Michelle's family moved again, this time to the bush, to Tokeen on El Capitan off the northwest coast of Prince of Wales. It was here that Michelle spent her formative teenage years. After attending college in Louisiana, she returned to Southeast Alaska. In 2012, she married the love of her life. Please welcome Michelle Hale to the stage.
When I was, I think, 16, I might have been 15, maybe 16, and I think it was in August. It had to have been about August because it got dark then. I'd been over to Little Naugatuy with my sister visiting some friends, and she decided she wanted to stay and spend the night. In fact, I think we must have prearranged that. But I wanted to go home, so I did. It was a beautiful late summer day. The water was flat calm. It was warm. And I was going the 9 miles from Naugatuy to Tokeen in my skiff, or in one of our skiffs. And that skiff was a flat-bottom, fiberglass, something-or-other skiff. And it was fun to run because it just bombed along on the surface of the water. We knew the area where I lived like the backs of our hands, so we would take all the shortcuts and we would do it at top speed because we knew where all the rocks were. There's this one passageway where the obvious passageway would be to go straight, but we knew that was full of rocks. So there's this great little shortcut that you could go around this little tiny island, go around very fast, this little island, which I did, as I'd done dozens of times before. And as I went around that little tiny island in this flat-bottom skiff, the skiff kind of porpoised along or kind of skipped along the water, and my outboard fell off the stern of the skiff. And we had learned by this time to tie our outboards on. We always had a little bolt, and we'd have our outboards tied on because they shake themselves loose, and once in a while they fall off if you forget to tighten the bolts. So that outboard was tied on, and when the outboard fell off, the skiff, of course, slowed down very quickly, and I leapt to my feet when the outboard fell off. The outboard was in the water, half submerged, still going, gurgling and chortling around in the water behind the skiff, and I was frantically reaching for the kill switch on the outboard. I found it, and I killed the outboard, and then I hauled it into the skiff, and I don't remember what it weighed. It's heavy, but, you know, if you're just kind of hauling it in, it's okay. So I got it into the back of the skiff, into the stern of the skiff. But when I had leapt to my feet when the outboard fell off, oh, then I noticed that the skiff was filling up with water very quickly because all our skiffs leaked, and they leaked a lot. And so when we ran the skiffs, we always ran with the plug out because that way the water that was coming into the skiff would go out the plug hole. So when I leapt to my feet, I noticed that the water was pouring in, but I couldn't find the plug. And as it turned out, when I leapt to my feet, I kicked the plug up into the bow of the skiff, and I couldn't find it. And meanwhile, the skiff is filling up with water. So I'm frantically searching for the plug. I found the plug finally, got the plug in, and bailed out a little bit of the water so I wouldn't be sloshing around in too much water. And then I kind of did an assessment. I decided, okay, it's 9 miles from Naugatuck to home. I was about 4 miles from Little Naugatuck. It was about 5 miles home. So I had three choices. I could go to the beach and wait for somebody to come find me. I could go back to Naugatuck, or I could go home. I'm not the kind of person that goes to the beach and waits for somebody to find me. And I really didn't want to go back to Naugatuck. I really did want to spend the night at home that night. So I was going to row home. Except I wasn't going to row home because this boat, it was kind of a wide fiberglass boat, and it's some homemade job. It didn't have oar locks. It had one oar, which I used as a paddle, so I sat on the bow of this flat-bottom skiff, and I started paddling home. And paddled down the channel towards home. At one point, and it started getting dark. It was the afternoon, but it started getting dark, and I knew it was going to take a while, which it took hours. And at one point, the tide, I paddled into Skookumchuck, which is named Skookumchuck for a good reason. And so at one point, the tide, as I was going through Skookumchuck, it brought me right next to the east side of El Capitan Island. And on that side of the island, the trees went right down to the water, and it was pretty high tide. And at a certain point, that was the only point I was afraid on the entire trip, I could feel that solid, dark island right beside me, and it really scared me. So I got myself back out into the channel and kept paddling. Paddled around the south end of the island, and then I was going up the west side, and Tokine is on the west side of El Capitan Island. And as I turned the corner, at a certain point, I could see the light. There's a light, a navigational aid opposite Tokine, and I could see the light. Once I could see the light, I knew it was about 2 miles from home, and I knew my mom would be really, really worried. For some reason, well, I know why. We were always, you know, we always had skiffs or outboards breaking down, and I think my brother had the other skiff, and he was at Texican Island at that time. So mom didn't have a skiff, so she couldn't even come after me, which is what she would have done. So I knew she'd be worried, and I knew it had to be pretty late, 10 or 11 o'clock at night. So when I could see the light, I started calling, "Mom!" I would stop rowing, stop paddling, so all the water would go quiet, and then, "Mom!" So then I wouldn't hear anything, so I'd keep going for another 10 minutes, stop, "Mom!" And finally, I heard, "Michelle!" in the distance. And I was like, "I'm okay." And then I kept paddling, and then, "Mom, I'm okay." And voices travel really well on the water. So it was quite a ways out. So finally I got in, and she was at the very end of the longest float at Tokine, very end of the float. And we were, as I got closer, we could talk to each other. And as I paddled in, she saw that the outboard was in the skiff, and she could tell exactly what had happened. She took the bow line, and I jumped out, and we just babbled over the top of each other. We were both so relieved to see each other, and I was home.
Jim was born and raised in the New Jersey bush. He first... Did you want to hear that again? New Jersey bush. He first moved west in 1990 to teach literature at a university in Washington. He didn't name it. He just said a university in Washington. And then in 1995, he moved to Juneau. He's a writer for the National Marine Fisheries Service, teaches part-time at UAS, and runs his own business giving professional writing workshops. Occasionally, he publishes essays on whatever strikes his fancy, and his latest publication, an essay called Lost in Ghent, speculates on the theology behind the famous 15th century Flemish painting, The Ghent Altarpiece. On December 1st, 2012, he married the great love of his life, Michelle Hale.
Actually, I'm going to tell another story about Michelle coming home. We'd been dating for a while, and in fact, we're already engaged. And Michelle was still spending most of her time in her condo in Anchorage when she needed shoulder surgery. And I'd had shoulder surgery myself a few years earlier, so I knew what she'd be going through. So I decided to go up to Anchorage to be with her that first week after the surgery. So, my surgery here in Juneau was an outpatient procedure. Ted Schwarting, who I think has had his knife into most people in this town. But up in Anchorage, they actually admitted Michelle into the hospital, and she had to spend the night there because, you know, they're still trying to, in Anchorage, their medical community is still trying to attain Juneau's level of care. So anyway, that first night in the hospital was a horrid night for Michelle. It was a really tough night. She couldn't sleep. The pain meds were having a bad effect. So it was a really bad night. So she was really relieved the next day. I came in, we packed her up, we got her out of the hospital, and we got her home, and then we went to sleep that night, and she couldn't sleep in the bed because the shoulder, the pain was just not allowing her to sleep in that position. So she'd come home, and she'd only had, you know, an even worse night that second night after the surgery. And so we decided the next day, well, we've got to do something about this. We've got to find a better situation for you to sleep in. So we went shopping at Fred Meyer's in Anchorage, there at the corner of New Seward Highway and Northern Lights. And we went to the furniture section, and we found a nice, you know, a love seat recliner that looked like it would do the job. So there's a young guy working at the sports counter. We go over there. We say, you know, we'd like to buy this couch, this love seat. He said, well, let me call my sales manager. So he calls gets on the phone and calls his sales manager. And, you know, pretty soon the sales manager comes walking over. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for the sales manager, Michelle starts telling me this story about, you know, years earlier, she'd been, you know, in her house, so she was living in Juneau here, and she got up one morning, and she's in the kitchen barefoot making breakfast, and she goes to open one of the cupboards. This mouse jumps out at her, jumps out onto the counter, onto the floor. Now, knowing Michelle as I do now, what happened next doesn't surprise me in the slightest. Mouse jumps out of the cabinet, onto the counter, onto the floor, and bam! Michelle stomps it with her bare foot and kills it. Lightning reflexes, I'm talking, you know, just boom, bam, slams, kills the mouse with her bare foot. So she finishes telling me this, and I look up, and there's the sales manager standing there. And, you know, and he's fiddling with some papers in his hand, and he's, you know, good manners, you know, he's trying to act like he didn't hear what just happened, but there's no way he couldn't have heard, so I look up and I said, did you hear that? Did you hear that? My fiance kills mice with her bare feet. And without missing a beat, this guy looks at me and says, well, if you don't want her, I'll take her. But I did. I wanted her more than ever. A woman who's been tested by the dark waters of Southeast Alaska and by its mice as well. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Rich Forst. Rich came to Alaska in 1982 with a backpack and $50. He is the first mudroom storyteller to text his bio, all of this that I'm reading. After hitchhiking around the state, he began a career with the U.S. Forest Service in Juneau. Then he moved to the National Park Service in Sitka, and then he worked for NOAA in law enforcement. He's been self-employed since 1991 and owns a marine wildlife company, still in text message. Rich is a pilot. He's a pilot, EMT, and a dive master, as well as an avid biker, runner, and swimmer. He met Amanda at... And I'm just reading here. He met Amanda at some half-ass triathlon where she roped him into speaking this gig. Here's Rich.
My story begins on a sunny afternoon in Sitka. I was mowing the lawn at our house, and my son came up to me and says, hey, Dad, there's a whale out there. It's really acting funny. So I look, and sure enough, this whale is breaching in the water and obviously in some kind of distress. So we decide that we'll go out and help this thing. We had a boat in the water at the time, and it had been diving that morning, so all of our dive gear was in the boat. And we wandered down the dock, and my son motored around to the whale there, and I was putting my gear on, and by the time we got there, I had all my gear on, was ready to get in the water. So by now, the whale had settled down a little bit and was just resting in the water. This was a humpback, a full-grown adult. So I got in the water, and I approached this whale from the front of it so it'd kind of know we were there and maybe have an idea of what was going on. And I got in the water and got down to the whale, and it was like approaching the fuselage of a jet, just huge. And got and saw that there was a line coming from its mouth and around its pectoral fin and down to its tail, and then continue on to the depths of the water. So I didn't want to get around this line too much, so I swam down to the tail and decided, well, I'll go down and see what's down there. I don't want to be messing with this or trying to cut it and have this whale take off with who knows what coming at me in the line. So I dove down to about 60 feet, a depth of 60 feet, and saw that there was a crab pot. And what had happened is this whale was struggling so much that it tangled itself up more, but it also got in a little bit shallower water where this commercial 100-pound pot was now sitting on the bottom. So I can see it just kind of rise up a little bit off the bottom and go down, and a small cloud of silt would be stirred up. Did that a couple times. So I cut it, got that off, and worked my way up the line to the tail. And every 3 feet, I would just make a cut, again, so nothing's behind me. Got up to the tail of this whale, and the line was wrapped about 7 times around the fluke and just embedded in the blubber, obviously very painful. I couldn't get my knife up in there to cut it, so I started to unwrap it. I had to pull. It was really embedded in the skin. And I made a couple laps around his tail, which is about 12 feet, so it's quite a swim, 12 and 12, 24, and that took a little time. I did that maybe two and a half times and decided, okay, I need to get this off here a little quicker. So I cut and was able to give it a tug a little bit, and I can feel it just kind of on the bone, and I knew it had to be extremely painful. But the whale stayed there and just waited for me to do this. And I was aware of the danger and what could happen, so I was keeping an eye on any movement or anything like that. So I was able to get that off and off its tail. And so now the whale could move a little bit. And it was just now on the surface breathing. So I worked my way to the pectoral fin and slowly cut the line again every few feet. And now there's line just kind of drifting all over in the water, just neutral all around me. And got that off of the pectoral fin and worked my way forward. And now I'm working forward and I'm cutting and cutting. I get closer and I get to the jaw, and first the eyeball and then the jaw. And at that point I realize, okay, you know, this is getting close to his mouth, and all he'd have to do is go like that and I'd just vortex into him. So for the first, I got a little nervous right then. And then I looked over and there he is. His eyeball was no farther than this away from me. And I looked him in the eye thinking, I'm cool. Are you cool? And we looked at each other, and the whale, I can tell you, a whale's eyeball is about the size of a softball. And he takes a slow blink just like that and back up. And I thought, okay. So I worked my way forward, and I saw that the line, there was a loop going right inside his mouth of about 1-inch line, pretty substantial line. I'd cut the remaining end of the crab pot line off and grabbed this and kind of gave it a tug, and it was really in there. So I hung on to it for a minute, and I put my foot up there, and I really pulled, and it wouldn't move. And at that point, the whale moved a little bit away from me. And I just reached with my knife, and I put it right under that loop, because I wanted to get that loop cut, thinking, well, it'll slide out at some point. And I was being pulled, and I cut it. I got it off. And then the whale turned, and he came to me, and now I surfaced. And my son, I had told him, just leave the thing running and be ready to come and get me if I wave. And he came right over, and he's there, and the whale's coming at me. And I put my arms out, not knowing what he was going to do, so I could just be brushed around him. And he came right at me. I had my arms out like this, and he turned a little bit, and pretty soon the pectoral fin came in contact with me, and he just gave me the most gentle but forceful like that, and I was just swept out of the way. My snorkel was flapping in the water, and I bit down on my regulator. The whale surfaced and was breathing and gave out several sounds or grunts about three times. So I took my BC and tank off and weight belt and threw it in the small whaler we had at the time and jumped in. And we watched this whale. We followed him for maybe 30 minutes, just really literally off into the sunset. And we later had learned that there was a whale spotted. It would have been about April of the following year in Hawaii with a small amount of line coming out of its mouth. So my son says to me, he goes, Dad, I think we saved him. I says, yeah, I think we saved him. So the whale was literally drowning, and we were able to untangle him, and he survived. So that's my story. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event on KTOO News Juno. These stories were recorded on October 9th, 2013 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Coming Home. Curious? Visit www.mudrooms.org. Jerry's early life on a farm in northern Ohio involved a lot of shoveling. Wheat, corn, silage, soybeans in the summer, coal, feed, and cow manure in the winter. They really only poop in the winter. Fixing busted equipment was a constant, and airplanes become a factor when the family converted a cornfield into a pilot training and air charter business. After a few summers bumming rides cross country with occasional spins, loops, and wingovers in the backseats of war surplus J3 Cubs, Jerry became an airplane geek with an impulse toward exploration and edgy adventure. Jerry's days as a pilot lasted through college at UAF in Fairbanks. Flying gave him this life lesson. Coming home in an airplane when fuel is low, daylight fading, storm clouds building with a radio full of static gives any pilot real fear, and it's a very fast way to learn who you really are. In late 1967, Jerry joined the Peace Corps as a volunteer field advisor to a cadastral survey program operated by the government of Afghanistan. Jerry came home to Fairbanks in the spring of 1969, married another Afghanistan volunteer attached to the World Health Organization built a house, raised some kids, and has had a good life. Welcome to the stage, Jerry.
I want you to think about, pretend there's a map up here in front of me, and you're looking at the map, I'm looking out at you. I want to give you some geography to give you some background for the story. I should learn to talk into this thing. So figured we got the map. Over here on the west is Istanbul, Turkey. 3,100 miles to the east is New Delhi, India. This essentially defines the Middle East, at least for the purposes of this story. The Afghanistan lies about here. And if I kind of expand it out and lay it across the map at a smaller scale, we've got the Afghan border touching Pakistan down here, and Iran, which covers the entire west border. Pakistan is on the south and the east. And if we go across to Afghanistan, from that corner, about 950 miles, it touches China. So it's as big as Texas, has about 30 million people in it. And it's been in the news every day since I served there. I mean, not just in one place in the news. It seems to be every place in the news, always, and probably will continue to be. So President John F. Kennedy created the Peace Corps in 1961, shortly after he was elected president. I was an undergraduate at the time, full of enthusiasm and idealism, all that good stuff. So I signed up, but it took me a couple of years before I actually finished the application. A complicated application. I had to go through an FBI vetting process. I was getting calls from friends years afterwards saying, what'd you do to get the FBI down on you? Well, I hadn't done anything. I was just applying to become a Peace Corps volunteer. I finally got a call from a Peace Corps recruiter who said, would you like to go into Afghanistan and the bush and work with Afghan survey crews? And my first question was, where is Afghanistan? And we worked all that stuff out. We started training in late 1967. There was about 60 of us in our first Peace Corps training program. We studied Farsi. That was the main thing we were to learn while we were in training. But we also broke off into technical groups, and my technical group had 9 people to start. We're learning about how to do cadastral surveys, or how to do the latest techniques in cadastral surveys, because that's what I was going to be assigned to do. The 9 people shrank to 3 by the time we got finished with training and sworn in as volunteers. And after we went out in the bush for the first time after being sworn in, there were only 2 of us left. The third guy dropped out. There was myself, and there was a fellow named Jim Rose, who was a Cornell-trained civil engineer. Jim and I went out in the field separately with the Afghan survey crews, and there's a whole book full of stories there, too. But we would occasionally come back into Kandahar. If you remember my Afghanistan map, Kandahar's south here. That's where the headquarters of the program lay. And we were there one day, and the Afghan boss of the field survey crews was a fellow named Shir Mohammed. And Shir Mohammed came up to us and asked us if we'd like to go to Chakansur with him to meet with community officials down there. We said yes before he changed his mind. We jumped in. We grabbed a driver, Aziz. We jumped in a travel all. We went west on the only paved road in Afghanistan at that time. And after about an hour, our driver turned off and started heading across the desert. There were no signs or anything. He just turned off the road and went across the desert. After about an hour, we started seeing buildings, structures, ruins, ancient ruins. They'd been there an awfully long time, covered with boiling sand. And this went on for hours, it seemed to me, in retrospect. It might not have been that long. But as far as the eye could see, there were these ancient ruins. We finally got to Chakansur. We checked into a Choi Hona, or a tea house. and a hotel. We had a dinner of an exciting dinner of unleavened bread, mutton, rice, tea, and some vegetables. And then we went upstairs to sleep. Once we got upstairs, we realized that this was not a Hyatt Regency. The beds we had to sleep on were rough wood, covered with mattress straw-filled ticks. And as we tried to sleep, we suddenly realized that the number of bugs and fleas in the area were not going to sleep unless we went upstairs. So we all went up to the roof. And we slept well on the roof. It was cool. It was silent. There was not much happening in Chakansur, Afghanistan at that late in the evening. And we slept well, and we woke up to a young man singing the call to prayer just as the dawn was breaking. And the call to prayer, he was very devout, it was very clear, very strong. In that place, that far away from a road or a highway, across 100 miles of desert with no civilization, I was profoundly moved by it. This is the call to prayer happens 5 times a day in the Muslim countries, and it is something to see. It's very physical. Laying your mat out, putting your hands down on the mat, touching your forehead to the ground, and repeating that 4 or 5 times during a prayer session. This is a dramatic thing. The next day, we were in the city of Chakansur, meeting with the city officials there. I say city. Chakansur is, I don't know, it's a small town. There's the hotel, and there's like a city building or a building where people met, and that's where we were. And a few houses. That was about it. As we were sitting there meeting, a camel caravan crossed in front of us. And the camel caravan, which we often saw while we were in field doing surveys in the field, usually there were many animals in the hundreds sometimes, goats and chickens and camels. And the women who were uncovered, caravan women never covered their heads like other Afghan women did. And there were men, usually the men were walking, small children, old people who ride the camels or ride donkeys. These are some dramatic things to see. The ones that came across that we saw in Chakansur, though, there were just guys, no women, no kids, no other animals. And the camel drivers were carrying Kalashnikovs with banana clips and bandoliers of ammunition across their chests. We never saw that in other caravans. I asked Shir Mohammed, why the armament? He said, well, you understand that the caravans are basically smugglers, and they have these bandoliers of equipment and the armaments when they cross the border between Afghanistan and Iran. So that was an education for me. So one last note that I wanted to pass along to you. I was exposed to the call to prayer again when I was visiting a friend of mine in Cairo, Egypt, in 2005. He and I decided that we would go to the top of a minaret in downtown, in the Muslim section of Cairo. So we went to the top of the minaret. It was about 150 feet off the streets. It was very narrow up there, a very small place. And as we were standing there, the call to prayer began. The mid-afternoon call to prayer began. And it kind of started quietly in the neighborhoods around the downtown area and rose to a crescendo that was overwhelming and deafening at the top of the minaret where we were. So this is a powerful force in the world, and Afghanistan and many things I learned while I did service in the Peace Corps, that's what I brought home when I came back after my service there. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Laura Haywood. She's been a Juneau resident for 11 years. Not one to settle for one career, she has had many, including sales girl, waitress, biologist, typesetter, scientific illustrator, graphic designer, technical writer, web designer, arts administrator, and impresario. All those careers, plus a misspent youth, have combined to produce someone with a lot of stories to tell. Here's Laura.
I'm going to tell you a story. This happened to me in 1976 when I was 25 years old. That year I had the greatest adventure of my life, and I'd love to tell you about it, but I'm really going to tell you about coming home from that adventure. But I better start by just saying, at the time I lived in Corvallis, Oregon. I'd finished school, working as a waitress. It was like a fish and chips pub kind of place. And there was this couple that used to come in all the time. They were oceanography professors, and they did all their research off the coast of Peru on studying coastal upwelling. And they told me they needed some grunt labor for their next research trip. And I thought, grunt labor, that's me. And they actually hired me. I didn't know much at 25, but I did know an adventure when I saw one. So I quit my job. I left my apartment, left a relationship, jumped on an airplane, and next thing I knew, I was in South America. So I'm not going to tell you much about the trip. I'll just give you a few highlights. I got to ride through the Panama Canal on the ship. I got to go to the Amazonian rainforest and be wined and dined by oil executives from Ecuador. I got to go to the Galapagos Islands. I got to ride the highest train in the world at the time. It went over 15,000 feet. It was so high that in first class you actually got oxygen bottles. I was in third class and they just told you to put your head between your knees, which worked also. And let's see, what else? I had studied this in college. I really had some incredible drunken nights in a bar that was on the, in the port town of Lima. It's called Callao. And I was sung to by Polish sailors. It was wonderful. And I got to hike to Machu Picchu with three Swiss men. Now, that last one turned out to not be a good decision on my part. These guys had grown up chasing cows up and down mountainsides. They were in a little better shape than I was. This, you may have heard about the Inca Trail. You end up going over passes that are over 9,000 feet. And it killed me. It just killed me. I couldn't begin to keep up with them, and they were not into waiting for me. And I've never met a challenge like that, and I barely made it, and I got really, really sick. I think the altitude kind of sapped my strength and my resistance, and I just got so, so sick. Really, all I could do was just limp back to Lima, meet the ship again. I was really sick, was out to sea, and finally, somebody mentioned that my eyes had kind of turned yellow. So I knew what that meant. That's jaundice. That's infectious hepatitis. I knew I'd gotten it from, sometimes I was so hot and tired on that hike, I just drank out of any old stream, which you really cannot do in the Andes, if there's people living everywhere. So anyway, got back into port. They took me to the hospital. I was there for 2 weeks, which was how long they deemed me to be contagious. And then they released me, but I was still very sick. And I had to decide what to do because I really had planned to keep traveling. I was planning on Bolivia next. And I decided to try to stick it out. And I thought maybe I could make it if I just rested in a hotel in Lima. And I got myself a room in the cheapest possible hotel, which was really gross, really disgusting. They had something that looked kind of like plumbing, but really didn't function that way. And about all I could do was just lie in my bed, and sometimes I'd drag myself out and get something to eat, but I was a mess. And then the other thing that was bringing me down was, there was this young man, he was kind of a friend of a friend. He was a medical student in Lima, and he decided to visit me on a regular basis, and exactly. I'm there in this bed, sick, miserable, and I felt completely trapped, I was the fly and in the spider web, and he was the spider, and I couldn't I couldn't just kick him out. I wasn't strong enough. And so his idea of a good time was for me to teach him how to pronounce words like, you know, medical words, how to pronounce English words. And so it started out, you know, fairly reasonable, but after a few days it kind of took a gynecological turn. I was really uncomfortable. So, like, okay, I started thinking about my parents' house, and, you know, it was beautiful and cozy and clean, and all I had to do was get on an airplane, but, you know, I really wanted to stick it out. So I found out the Lima Symphony was playing a concert, and I thought, that will make me feel good. I actually took a cab, went to the symphony, beautiful symphony hall. And, you know, it was great. I couldn't read the program, but I recognized the composer's names, and it was great. I was just really loving it. And the very last piece was by Haydn. Got through the first few movements, beautiful music, and then the last one started, and it went along for a while. And then this guy, one of the players, actually got up. He packed up his stuff, and he left the stage. I thought, oh, my God, is he sick? And then another person did it, and then another one did it, and then one by one, all the musicians left the stage, and there was just this violinist left. He finished up. The conductor kind of blew out. There was a candelabra on stage. He blew out the candles and left. And it hit me really hard. I felt like, this is about me. I need to go. I need to leave. I need to blow out the candles and go. So I did. I found out later this piece is called the Farewell Symphony. Maybe you've heard of it. And it was actually written by Haydn to send a message to his patron that he and his players were leaving. And so anyway, it was a hard decision. I did it. And I just also want you to know it turned out to be a good decision, because a year later, these same oceanographers sent me back down to Peru, and I got to finish my adventure. Thank you.
Mr. Ryan Conroe is a Juno Theater guy. His first public performance of note was as the MC in The Cricket in the Thicket at Joseph Martin Elementary School in Hinesville, Georgia. His fellow Boy Scout James Barlament nabbed the role of the cricket, but Ryan had more lines, so that made him feel better. He enjoyed critical acclaim for his work in that role. His father and mother said that he was, quote, really good. 2 years later, he performed once again as an MC in Lumpkin County Elementary's Songs of the States. In a scene that featured a stage interruption by one of his classmates wearing a costume beard and pretending to be Willie Nelson. The critics were once again impressed, noting that, quote, we really thought that he was interrupting you, and we really thought he was Willie Nelson. 22 years later, and Ryan still finds himself goofing around on stage, though he prefers the cricket and Willie Nelson roles over the MC roles these days. He came to Juno 10 years ago this fall. Ryan Conroe.
Amanda gave me a call, left me a voicemail in August about being part of tonight, and I was really excited to get the message. And I was in Kotzebue visiting a friend of mine, fishing with him. And the next day after getting the message, I was thinking about this theme coming home. We were fishing. We were out in Kotzebue Sound in his skiff. And I was just taking in the day. It was a really gorgeous day. Calm water and the Noatak Hills on the other side of Kotzebue Sound. My feet were in my borrowed rubber boots and on the nets and corks. I had a cup of coffee. It was really early in the morning, and I felt really grounded and really comfortable, and I felt really at home. And This week in Kotzebue was tacked on to a couple weeks of work up in Nome, so I had just stayed away from home in Juneau for an additional week to goof off with a friend, and that marked 3 months of being not home in Juneau. And this has been part for the course for me for the past few years. I've been spending a lot of time working out of town and then often, you know, arranging goof off time next to work time. And so really not being home a lot. And so it got me thinking, what does it mean for me to come home? Where is home? What is home? And, I think that part of that, sense of exploration and transience, was something that was sort of part of my training. My father was in the Army, and we moved around a lot growing up. And I think back on experiencing all these different cities in the United States, and really my mother sort of coaching us through new neighborhoods, new schools, new friends, and in the meantime, my father really modeling the word that I come up with a lot describing him is curious. He's a curious person. He's very curious about new places and new people. And I really hope to emulate that. And I think that it's a quality that I continue to carry. I really enjoy being in new places. And in fact, it made me think that maybe in some ways I feel most at home when I'm in a way also uncomfortable, when I'm sort of out of my comfort zone. I keep putting myself in situations where I don't know the language, where I don't know anyone, where I don't necessarily know the protocol right now. What are you supposed to do when something like this happens or in this setting? And in a way that's very uncomfortable, but in another way it brings me right to the present. And when I think about those years growing up, traveling, I developed this kind of obsession with natural disasters as a kid. And my fifth grade teacher back at Lumpkin County Elementary had us write an autobiography that we bound in little, you know, hard paper and gave to our parents for Christmas or something. And mine was charting my own life around natural disasters that I had been near, but none of them I had actually been in. So like chapter one, I was born, which was not a natural disaster, but, chapter two was my third year. We lived in Honolulu and there was a hurricane, but it hit a different island. But I'd heard about it. And, chapter three, we were living in a suburb of Denver and there were tornadoes nearby. And then the chapter four was a blizzard. And chapter five was visiting my grandmother in Florida and a shark almost attacked someone at a beach near where we had been the day before. And so these were the big moments. And in a way, I kind of was sort of going through life, sort of collecting them. I still kind of have this sort of sentimental or romantic fascination with bad weather. You know, I love it when the Taku winds blow here and that sort of cozy feeling. And you know, it's so cozy. So anyhow, at the same time, though, I find that I do love keeping a nest, and it makes it all the sweeter when I get to really come home. And I've loved calling Juneau home for the past 10 years. But with all the travel, a lot in Western Alaska with work, I kept a place in Anchorage for a couple of years, and I arranged a calendar with friends, and so we would sort of share a sublet from each other or whatever, this apartment. And a couple of years ago, I was spending the whole fall out of Anchorage, and these friends were there, and we were corresponding occasionally by email, and they wrote to me, "New neighbors upstairs." Cool. They seem nice. It's a couple. And one of them is a little heavy on his feet. Okay, cool. They started calling him Stompy in the emails. They were also a little loud in other ways. At night. And the bedroom was right above our bedroom. And so, you know, so they started calling him Stompy Ooker. I practiced that before. Did that work? Did you get it? Stompy Ooker. Okay, so you get it. I'm getting these emails and it's kind of funny, and they had like, they talked to the landlord and they even like talked to Stompy about this, which I was really glad that I wasn't a part of that conversation. It was kind of funny to me, but I was getting more and more anxious as the time came for me to trade the place and move in there. And, Christmas time rolled around and I came back to the place in Anchorage and, settled in. and waited. I was sort of curious. And there was stomping. There was a fair amount of stomping. It was okay. And nothing else for several days. And then about the sixth day or so, it was late. I was in bed. I was sitting up. I was on Facebook on my computer. And it was about midnight. And I had heard some stomping around upstairs earlier, but that all had been quiet for a little while. And then suddenly, there was this, like, and I was like, oh. And I sort of looked up, and then there was, like, this thump. And so I put my computer aside, and I was like, okay, here goes. This is it. And then there was another thump, and there was another, and sort of this, like, rhythmic thing began. And it kept going and sort of increasing in intensity. And, in fact, it started feeling like the whole – it started feeling like movement, like there was this movement happening. And I was sitting there in bed, like, what is going on? Like, how is he doing that? Like, what is, like, the swaying? And I was thinking about, like, the foundation of the building, like, how's the building constructed, and how could this possibly be possible? I mean, how can he do that? And so I sat there dumbfounded. It stopped. It subsided. And finally, I picked up my computer, and I clicked refresh on my Facebook news feed. I had never been in an earthquake before. And, of course, all of my South Central friends in their posts from the past 5 minutes helped me realize that I had spent my very first earthquake thinking that it was my upstairs neighbors spooking. Thank you.
KTOO News Juneau 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on October 9th. The theme for the evening was Coming Home. Music was performed by Dan Kirkwood.